You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Ray Cass, who is professor emeritus of art at Virginia Tech, as well as founder and director of the Mountain Lake Workshop, an ongoing series of collaborative and interrelated workshops centered in the environmental, cultural, and community resources of the Appalachian region of southwestern Virginia. The Mountain Lake Workshops have resulted in many unique collaborative works of art widely exhibited. Artists have included folk artist Howard Finster, Japanese artist and sculptor Jiro Okura, waste management installation artist Merle Lederman-Ukeles, official if unsalaried artist in residence of the New York Sanitation Department, ceramic artist, poet, and author M.C. Richards, Colorado-based eco-artist Lynn Hull, New York City East Harlem street artist James de la Vega, Zen art scholar and artist Stephen Addis, Paris-based sculptor and virtual reality light artist Jackie Matisse, and of course, John Cage and Ray Cass himself. Ray has contributed much to Cage scholarship over the years, numbering among his most important books, John Cage, Zen Ox Herding Pictures with Stephen Addis from 2009, The Sight of Silence, John Cage's Complete Watercolors from 2011, and Mountain Lake Symposium and Workshop, Art in Locale with Howard Rosati in 2018. He's also contributed a variety of critical essays to exhibition catalogs and other important publications. Also joining the conversation tonight is Jade Dellinger, who's been with me on All Things Cage before. Jade is the director of the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery in Fort Myers, and along with Ray Cass, has a new show opening at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center in Asheville this fall, entitled Don't Blame It on Zen, The Way of John Cage and Friends. Ray's show, which is currently running at the nearby Asheville Art Museum, is entitled Rural Avant-Garde, The Mountain Lake Experience. So welcome to All Things Cage, Jade and Ray. It's so great to have both of you here today.
Thanks again. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
It's lovely to see you both on the same screen. Ray, we've done two shows for All Things Cage with Jade so far, but we've never done a show with you. So I was wondering, could we start with you, and you and I can talk a little bit, if you like, about how your relationship with Cage came about. How did that happen for you?
I was aware of his work as a child. My brother and I took Fontana Mix, I think, out of the library because we would take records out. And when we played it, we'd never heard anything like it. So we thought it was a riot. We invited all the kids in the neighborhood over to listen to this. And it was just a tremendous hoot. My real introduction to John Cage happened through Morris Graves when I was living in Northern California near Graves. I developed an important project with Graves through doing his retrospective at the Whitney Museum. And that required me doing interviews with John. I had met John a couple of times before that, 1976, at a fine arts festival in Chapel Hill. Meredith Monk and Stan Brakhage were there. I said hello to him backstage, and we had Graves in common as a mutual friend, but I didn't expect to see him again. I hadn't begun the work with the project for the Phillips Collection yet, but I got a call at midnight at a house I was staying in Chapel Hill, from friends who were putting Cage up, and they said he wants to play chess and nobody here can play chess. So I had been on the chess team, and I got up and got dressed and got there at 12:30 at night, and I played chess, but I didn't play chess with John. I played chess with Greet Sultan, and he watched the games. Later, I realized this is very much what he and Tini would do, playing chess with Marcel, that Marcel would watch the game, or he would also play with John. But this was very interesting to me. And she beat me three times. He enjoyed it thoroughly. then the Phillips Collection wanted to do the Morris Graves retrospective. And when I called him up to do interviews with him, at least I knew him. I had met him, you know. He would schedule the interviews usually early, 9 a.m. For me, that's very early now. And I would be down there on front of the apartment right on time. I would set the whole 3 hours of the morning aside, figuring this is going to be great. It's going to take some serious time. He would buzz me in and have me into the apartment. I would ask my questions. He would answer them immediately. Then he would even take some time to show me what he was working on at Crown Point Press, which were the big prints at the time. This is 1980. And I began to become engaged with him as a visual artist, understanding this is something that meant a great deal to him. And there was, you know, he was beginning to do the Ryoanji drawings. The prints for Ryoanji actually preceded the drawings. Very interesting relationship there. And I asked him if he would ever be interested in doing watercolor painting. And he said, oh, how could I do that? My artist friends have so many studio assistants and people helping them, and I wouldn't have room there. So essentially what I did, inviting him to Mountain Lake for what was a mycological foray with Orson Miller, mushroom hunting, he wanted to meet Orson and Orson wanted to meet him. They knew of each other, but they'd never met. He came down and was there for days, several days, really, gave the four first sections of Mushrooms et Baryatones, which he wrote for that conference, which was in mycology, essentially. And I had him out to my studio the last day, and the studio assistants and myself had arranged everything I had in the studio, the rocks, the brushes, papers, all the different papers we had. They were all assigned numbers and things. Through studying his work with Catherine Brown, I understood how he was operating, making his visual artworks. And Catherine Brown was essential in that. Without the experience in printmaking, I wouldn't have had a foothold in how to organize things that maybe he would have a painting experience. And he was on his way to the airport and only had 2 hours and came in and looked at the way we'd prepared everything and painted three paintings in 1983 at the end of the mycological foray. One of which I took to New York and left with him to see how he would feel about it. Two of them were more or less test pieces. And he said, I would like to do this, I think. He eventually signed that piece and I think it got sold to a museum somewhere in the Midwest. Circumstances were that it took 5 years to organize his first real painting experience with him at Mountain Lake. And that was in 1988 when he made 60 or so watercolors, New River watercolors called. There was four series using chance operations for everything. We did that at Mountain Lake at the Horton Studio, right near the hotel. And then he returned again in 89 when I organized, working with Radford College, a visit there where he gave a reading. He showed up the next morning. I picked him up and we'd prepped the studio for steps. We'd gone back and forth on the phone a number of times in the previous weeks. John would paint again, but we had to do something different. He didn't want to do the same thing again. That's very much like him, I think. You know, we built the first big brush trough and those things, and I think he performed it in under a minute. Peter Lau was the only person who was actually in the room with it, though Bob Kamisha and Peter Lau both helped set it up, and other of the assistants built the brush and the trough. That was 1989. That was long before we thought of that becoming a performance piece that could be done by other people. But now, as you know, and with your agency, it was published by C.F. Peters in 2017, Steps, a Composition for a Painting.
Ray, back up a little bit for our listening audience, because they're not going to know a lot about the Mountain Lake Workshop. So when did that start?
Began as an art criticism symposium in 1980, and I did two conferences a year, just amazes me now, the idea that I could organize two conferences a year like that. The underwriter was Mary Moody Northern, who owned Mountain Lake Hotel, was in almost 90 years old at the time, and became my benefactor in these things. And the conferences were theoretical criticism, and I did them with Donald Cuspet. And after 1983, I did them with Cuspet and with Howard Rosati, my colleague, who's co-editor of the book, Art in Locale, The Mountain Lake Experience. That came out in 2018. It's a collaborative workshop that engaged traditional Appalachian values of community. It also engaged artists in collaborating with tech resources at Virginia Tech, various technological departments and programs. I wrote grants for it every year and got 95% of them, I would say. And Virginia Tech didn't have very much money in the project. They had nothing in the project, really. They gave me an account in the Tech Foundation that I didn't have to create a small private foundation at that time. But we did 21 conferences over a 10 and a half year period. Fall conference was theoretical criticism with people like Irving Sandler, Rosalind Krauss, Clement Greenberg, people of note of that period, of that day. And they were very serious. And we usually had an attendance at the hotel of about 100, because it could barely hold 100. And, you know, I would have students bust up to it and things. They went on all day, every day, open bar, things you could never have now. Tremendous arguments between the participants, particularly Krauss and Cuspet. In 1983, because the spring conference was supposed to be artist-centered, we could never get the artists to come out and really talk about their artistic motives or, you know, other purposes behind their work or their strategies. They would show slides and talk in general about themselves, but we couldn't get into the artistic motive. So I started Lake Workshop in 1983, and John Cage was the first one, really.
I never realized
it was the first one that brought together a scientist like Orson Miller. That he was what?
I never realized he was first.
Yeah, he came down with Marie Cassandis, the photographer, Robert Berlin, the painter. I was kind of hoping to cross-pollinate Berlin and Cage a little bit, but he stuck pretty closely to the mycological foray in Orson Miller. Orson gave a very important paper on it that I have documented, and I have John on video reading those first four sections of Mushrooms et Verretones. At the end of that workshop, we took him to a location on the New River called Ripplemead, which had fantastic stones, big stones. And I took a truck and I took a sufficient amount of coming the Mountain Lake assistants with me. And he just spent a long time wandering around among these beautiful stones, this river that flows backwards that possibly is the oldest river in the world. It's now credited with at least being the second oldest river in the world. In fact, we filled my van up with stones. You saw them because the first group of stones were the stones I brought to him in New York. I had a studio on Vestry Street, 67 Vestry Street at that time. John came over to visit. I had the stones all stacked up on top of one another. They weren't that precarious, but he loved them. So before I left New York, the van arrived at Merce and John's house with these stones in them. I thought, well, this will inspire him.
It did.
And it did. I left that painting there for 5 years and he liked the stones. And to my amazement, in 1988, I got this phone call. There was this gap in his schedule where he could come down for a week. And we did the New River rocks and watercolors.
I remember
intermittently,
that very well.
You know, we worked with a number of artists. We worked with Merle Lauder-Queens, who was the artist in residence of the New York Sanitation Department. We worked with her in anaerobic microbiology, which she'd never done before. We worked with Howard Finster. Howard Finster said, it doesn't matter who holds the brush, which is the same thing John said when he was doing his 1988 paintings. So we always made John hold the brush for the principal limning.
Right.
Cage met Finster at Finster's retrospective, which was when the American Folk Art Museum was at Prudential, I think, and called me up at 11:30 at night saying, well, I met this amazing person, and all I can say is he's absolutely not a phony. And of course, Howard Finster talked all the time. I was impressed. You would never associate Cage and Finster, but he thought they had a great affinity.
How interesting. You know, Ray, one of the things that I remember about you that I think made this all possible was that you, by the time you met John Cage, you had done a lot of research, if you will, in understanding how Cage used chance operations. You understood the quantification of materials and that nothing could happen without that. And I remember seeing those when John was actually there and doing the workshops with you, how you had these enormous rocks out on the deck and they all had big pieces of masking tape stuck on them with numbers.
Right.
You had all the little paintbrushes lined up with little numbers at the bottom. And I'm quite sure that
we had them in groups.
Yes, but not everybody understood
rocks that were small, rocks that were medium, and rocks that were big. Everything was numbered. Everything was given an orientation. And the same with brushes and with batches of paper. The amount of paper in that batch, the size of it, and rolls of paper as well. And without Catherine Brown's precedent, I wouldn't have been able to figure all that out. And Bill Anastasi was very important because I would call Bill Anastasi up and ask him questions and things, and he was actually very, very helpful.
There was a brush from Tom Marioni, right, Ray?
The feather brush that John particularly liked, which is now in Germany, which I hope to get back someday, but otherwise it'll be at Halberstadt. Nobody knew what that brush was. Tom Marioni got this brush somewhere in San Francisco and gave it to John. John gave it to me. We used it. He used it quite a bit in that painting that's in the Virginia Museum. New River Watercolors, Series 4, Number 1. That's the painting that took almost 9 hours to paint. It had like 218 moves in it or something. And that was also the day that John invited people to visit the workshop, like journalists and people like that. And he was so focused in his work. He was working on this painting that was an exhausting experience. And people would come in and he would say hello to them, be very respectful, just like the visits I would have with him in 1980 and 81. I said I would leave the whole morning open for it. I'd be back down on the street within 15 or 20 minutes. And this is even after he would have shown me the prints he was working on, Catherine Brown. That's how absolutely focused and efficient he was.
That brush freed him, though, in a way, right, Ray? I mean, in terms of it, the use of feathers.
Yeah, he didn't want to use the conventional brush. He only, you know, I should have said this earlier, but in the 1988 workshops for series 1, 2, and 3, he painted with pheasant wing feathers, or essentially like peacock feathers. They have a very strong glide wing spine. And because I taught at Virginia Tech and we have a huge agricultural department, I was able to get peafowl feather wings without having to pull them off birds.
Right. Thank you.
The first three series, including the washes, which we would make out of the poultry department's big chicken wings sometimes, that's all feathers. He didn't want to use a conventional tool. A brush is a little stick with hair on the end, but it has centuries and centuries of history. Mm-hmm. And series 4, the painting he painted for the Virginia Museum in 1988, Number 1, the one that's in the Virginia Museum, it was one of what became 9 paintings, then he decided to use brushes for that last painting 2 days at the Mountain Lake Workshop in 1988.
Ray, do you remember things that he said about not wanting to use a brush?
He felt it was such a conventional and traditional tool that he simply wanted to use something he could make a mark with that would sidestep the tradition of the brush. And as he gained confidence in looking at the paintings and things and looking at the way we'd arranged and organized the brushes, when he chose to use the brush in New River Watercolors Series 4 in 1988, he was very aware of it. And I realized that he was trying to do something that he didn't want it to be automatic, but he wanted it to be random. He didn't want it to be mannered in the sense that he was trying to acquire a particular skill with it. But that happens inevitably because he would remark after almost every surrounding mark, a comment. Like if he liked it, he'd say, beautiful. Similar to what happened in his experience with Catherine Brown, beginning with engraving, right? Whatever he was doing, he was always trying, in, I think, just out of the form of his personality, the nature, his nature, to get better at it. And he got good at it. But I think the paintings are remarkable because he's accepting himself in those paintings as one of the elements of the artwork in an actively conscious way. And that's an important dimension of indeterminacy to me in his work. He didn't make art out of concepts, he made art out of things. And in the paintings, he accepted himself as one of the things.
Do you think, Ray, that he had any, I don't even know what the word would be, you know, but coming out of his very close relationship and respectful relationship with Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg in particular, but also Morris Graves, there are others, Cy Twombly. He had these relationships with these artists, and I wonder how much he talked about or said to you about a kind of reticence that he had in encroaching on their domains, if you will, of daring to move into a medium that wasn't his, so to speak. For example, Ray, when I went and gave a talk at the Fort Myers, the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, before it was the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, I think, or maybe right at the same time, Bob Rauschenberg came with me. He actually gave me a ride to the gallery and stayed there with me. And I had the cheekiness to draw him into the conversation, and he went right with it. He was so lovely and talked about this. But he said to me over a beer after that show that he had no idea that John was making such beautiful work, that he just had no idea, that John never really talked about it. He never saw it. And I just wonder if John had kept that from him for a number of reasons I can imagine, but I never asked him. Did he ever mention anything?
Well, I mean, going back to Morris Graves, when I told Morris that we had done this workshop with John, Morris's reaction was, he should stick to composing. Yes. I think Jasper Johns later bought a piece of Cage's work, which he gifted to the Whitney. But I think that Rauschenberg, in particular, when I went to Marguerite's when Merce Cunningham was having a show there, and I talked to him about these, and he said, I had no idea he was doing these drawings.
Yeah. So I think that John was just
parts of their individual lives they didn't know about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I find that fascinating. Don't you?
I do too.
It seemed again like that brush from Tom Marioni sort of freed him in the sense of not feeling self-conscious about the mark making, that it didn't have to, you know, have a technical mastery, or that there was, you know, in that sense. So, you know, as he said in one of the videos, I think that you documented some of his visits through, you know, it really allowed him to be free of being concerned about the brush or the brush stroke. So,
yeah, he was able to get involved with it that way. And when he got involved and he got interested, we just rigorously followed chance operations and whatever mark the instrument, whatever he was using, made. Of course, it was either feathers and brushes, finally. He tried to do that unselfconsciously, but I often do relate it to those big prints, because he was very interested in those when he would show them to me, the stages they were at. I guess the three sets of the really big prints Kathryn Brown did. Very few people today, to this day, realize he has almost 1,000 dedicated artworks.
Right.
Yeah. Individual signed artworks.
Yeah. I think the question I asked you is probably a little unfair when I think about it, because Jasper and Bob Rauschenberg and Morris Graves were very different people. You know, they didn't have the same relationship with Cage, and they certainly were different from each other. But thinking about it, Bob was more than Jasper or Morris Graves, I guess, was also uninhibited about treading into other media. Like for the Nine Evenings piece, he was roller skating with the, you know, with the parachute or the umbrella. Right. And then late in his life, Bob was doing music. He was improvising with, you know, Found Objects with Lawrence Wojtek. I did a show with Lawrence where we played a recording session that Bob is actually playing in. Bob had an electric piano in his house that he played.
Strategic structures,
exactly. That's the one that they captured, which was a kind of improv session.
They were instruments built with scraps from the studio, with bits of things that were being used for building the Borealises, or so they made these plates that could be vibrated, or yeah.
Right, that's no different, is it, than the peacock feathers of taking away the implements that could be perfected, and rather there was something that you could explore with, the same way that John did with Ray, with materials, maybe. I don't know. It's just, you know, it's interesting to think about, because I always remembered Bob saying he had no idea that John had made all of these works. And it's like, how can that be? You know, they knew each other for 45 years. How could they not, you know, be more intimate than that? But they weren't. But let's go back to steps, because one of the reasons I wanted to have the two of you on together is that, Jade, you've done two shows with Ray's work. Is that true? With Cage?
Well, the forthcoming exhibition will include, you know, one of the steps works that our all mutual friend Lawrence Wojtek, who worked with Bob, had worked on. And of course, it's a nice segue you're making, because of the steps works, as we understand them from Ray, too, were a kind of homage to Bob and John in that sense, with the automobile tire print. So
that's
maybe
exactly
Ray could
right.
talk more about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it also struck me, Ray, when you were talking about John finally picking up the brush in series 4 in 1988. And you kind of talked about it being a kind of culmination. Wasn't steps a kind of culmination in the sense of using his feet as the implement? You know, it's like, if you think about it
yes.
that way, there was that.
The big decision was whether to wear shoes.
And what did he do?
He made the right decision in his case, wearing shoes. Yes. And it happened in an instant, but the conversations that went back and forth in the previous weeks, I had cited Rauschenberg's tire track, and I had read in Cage's literature, but who drove the car? So this gets into the question, how many people does it take to make a work of art? You know? Or it isn't, yeah. And one of the Mountain Lake symposiums we had, I had Howard Becker and I think Robert Pincus Whitten. And Pincus Whitten was preoccupied a little bit with who gets to say what's a work of art. And well, there's a certain level of artist that if you reach that height, you can. There are critics and some historians like Leo Steinberg. I mean, if they have enough bearing and authority, they can. But For Howard Becker, it was much more sociologically spread. It was how many people participate in all of the gathering of materials and things, and the even the concept of the audience for the work of art, participate in the work of art, and have in that measure some level of co-authorship. One of the things I liked about projects at the Mountain Lake Workshop was I tried to involve as many participants, this was very true of Cage's workshops, at as many intervals as I could so people could get the experience of working on that interface. But they also were the primary audience. They were the primary audience for the works that were created. It's like dropping a pebble in a pond or a puddle. You get rings going out from it. And their friends, of course, we would exhibit everything as soon as we finished it. That's one thing we often did. They become the secondary audience. The community eventually that it was created in, Blacksburg and Christiansburg, Virginia, where I live, a place that you would think would not care about brooding abstract art, would love these things because they felt very, very, very connected to them. You know, we gathered the materials there. We involved as many people as we could in the making of it. They involved as many people as they could, their friends and all, in the first exhibitions of it. So psychologically, they owned it. Uh-huh, that was part of my motivation, because when I came to living where I'm living in the Appalachians, a relatively isolated area still at that time.
It was quite different than what Cage had been doing with Ryuanji drawing. That was a very personal, meditative, isolated activity. You and created a very different studio practice.
For our audience who may not know what all these things are, so the Ryuanji drawings were drawings that Cage made. As Ray pointed out earlier, he made prints out of them first. He made Ryuanji prints, but then that evolved into this very solitary at-home practice with a light board and a grid. And then he would overlay this beautiful handmade rag Indian paper, and he would trace around rocks, which he did not steal from the Ryuanji Gardens in Kyoto, which many people like to think, but he had little stones that replicated the different kinds of shapes, and he would trace around them with chance-determined graphite pencils. I like to think of the Ryuanji drawings as kind of ore John Cage. They're like the purest Cage because they were done without any assistance, without any audience, without anybody helping. He just did this quietly when he had time at home.
I agree with that. And frankly, when his first visit here in 1983, I organized a fairly large exhibition of his visual artworks to date. That included, of course, a great many of his prints, but also included the Ryuanji drawings. And the Ryuanji drawings in that exhibition were the catalyst to the paintings. I said to him, I said, well, if you can do this, you can paint. And I think that's when he said, how would I paint? My artist friends have these great big spaces. They have all these assistants. Well, we created a studio practice for him.
Right.
And studied his work, organized it in a way appropriate for him to access it using chance and the implicit indeterminacy.
Exactly.
Of his late visual artwork, which is a remarkable feature of it.
Yeah. One of the things that's so striking about all of the watercolors, including going forward with the River Rocks and Smoke, where you start to smoke paper, I think about those works as being very visual. I don't mean the works themselves, but the activity of the making of those works. You know, you have these guys all around with these tarps and the smoke pouring off of things. And it's very tactile and very broad. It's very broad. So.
And they become monumental, ultimately.
Yes, but they're very
young different. Young men and young women. I know we had a lot of, you know, Jerry nicknamed all the Diggy Boys, but there were a lot of girls too. And
there were Diggy
tried
girls.
To do, Peter Lau was the job captain. There were many, And I would pull them out of the context of the university because most of them were students. And in those days, you could write a letter to a student's professor saying, Gloria is going to miss classes for a week, but she's going to be working with me with John Cage. And I'd get an immediate response, okay. I don't know if it would work like that today.
Right, right. Ray, why did Jerry call them the Diggy Boys?
Because we were building the guest house and building the gardens and around Hego Garden where we live on the Roanoke River. And these same kids were kids I was employing to build a house, an 1800 square foot house essentially, which we had to rebuild 2.5 times because kids don't know how to build anything. So you don't save money this way, but they learn a lot. And we also put in the Japanese garden and the ram-packed earth wall in front of it and all that. Those were all done by two generations of overlapping students who also were the Mountain Lake Workshop assistants.
Uh-huh. It's such a lovely lineage.
You get some sense of it from the book because you can see that. When I taught at Virginia Tech, I always taught outdoors if I could. You know, I would take them out to paint landscape or paint abstract completely, take them to locations, things that would, again, be hard to do because the university does nothing but worry about liability. Mm-hmm. But what was beautiful about it is I believe since many of them still visit us to this day, just coming one is coming this afternoon later. This is years later. They say, well, that was the most important time I had at Virginia Tech, the most important experience I had. Very much in favor of not teaching in the classroom.
So listen, both of you, we have about not quite 10 minutes left. And I want you to tell the audience what's coming up for both of you, because this is very special. Ray, you have a show coming up at the Asheville Art Museum that is opening today.
It opened yesterday.
Oh, it did open yesterday.
It's called Rural Avant-Garde, the Mountain Lake Experience.
Nice, nice.
And that was organized by Longwood Center for the Visual Arts, Alex Grabiak and Rachel Talent Ivers invited me to do that show, which took us several years. And the big book, the book that's too heavy that accompanies it, is the entire history, the Mountain Lake Symposiums and Workshops, which is co-edited with my great colleague, Howard Rosati, who's also a big contributing author in it. That came out in 2018. So it'll be up until November 1st, not very long, and unfortunately won't overlap that much with the exhibition Jade is doing at the Black Mountain Museum and
Art Center.
Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center.
It's a terrible name. Let's just admit it. It's a terrible
too many
name.
Words.
Just too many words.
It's now located right across the street from the Asheville Art Museum where the Mountain Lake show will be.
That's right.
And Francis Thompson, who runs the art collections for Capital One for the whole Western Hemisphere, went to them and saw them and said, let's try to coordinate something between these two exhibitions, when he realized they'd be going on. But I have yet to hear anything from the, you know, Black Mountain College Museum and Cultural Center. However, I've dealt very well with Alice Siebrel and people in the past, and I gave them pieces by M.C. Richards. And I have my Jonathan Williams stuff I have to dispose of.
Of course, of course.
I was on the board.
I don't think that two museums speak very, very much. I don't think they talk to each other. And your show?
Well, we will do our best to connect these things as we move forward. And it was very kind of the Asheville Art Museum and you, Ray, to have us all be invited yesterday to the festivities there. But we have yet to actually begin installation. I'm heading to Asheville this weekend to sort of oversee some of that. And we're just thrilled that, you know, you'll have a room dedicated to Cage just blocks away from this exhibition that I'm curating there called Don't Blame It on Zen, The Way of John Cage and Friends. And of course, we'll be featuring Lawrence Wojtek's Steps piece that was produced here when you both came down at the Bob Rauschenberg Gallery. And even that exhibition that we did in 2019 was could not have happened had it not been for your rural avant-garde exhibition happening to be in storage in between venues. So we managed to pull the entirety of our exhibition, well, with the exception then of New River Rocks and Washes, which was then once again kind of newly rediscovered. But that really came out of your rural avant-garde exhibition as there was a small window of time when things were in between different venues. But with Don't Blame It on Zen, The Way of John Cage and Friends, we're lucky that it'll run until January. And there are a number of activities in October that are being organized through the University of North Carolina in Asheville, the Faith and Arts Institute. So Kay Larson is coming, which I'm thrilled about, and a number of other scholars who will be focusing and addressing Zen practice and Zen scholarship. And then in November, our lovely friend here, Laura Kuhn, will be the keynote for the reviewing programs that last 3 or 4 days. I think it's November 12th through the 14th. So that's going to be a fun thing that happens in November. But
And Jade Dellinger and Laura Kuhn will be performing a bit of John Cage's Indeterminacy as part of the reviewing conference. Ta-da! They just happened to pick up the old, really wonderful LP set.
Folkways LP. Well, but and this
I'm
is
still hoping to go down and see the exhibitions, but I'm going to come on your second visit, I guess, Jade. What you mentioned you were going to be there in October.
October, perhaps, and then certainly in November, I'll be there. We're trying to work all of that out, you know, now. And again, for all of us, I mean, I think with everything going on with COVID, it's so much is still up in the air about public events and how to handle them. So, you know, those are still questions. But we're moving ahead as best we can, and certainly the show will be up, I'm sure, in both locations as planned. But
Jade, when does your show open and when does it close?
It officially opens, I think it's September 3rd at Black Mountain College Museum. And again, without any real fanfare, but, and then the events again will happen in October and November, and it runs until January. I don't have the date right in front of me at this moment, but it's
okay. But that's a nice long run. It's good.
Yeah. It's a long run, which is fantastic. Well, I'm really pleased.
You have to send me the itinerary when people will be coming, because I would like to go down and just see the exhibitions on a normal day, quiet day, a mask wearing day, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm going to be doing a Zoom with their collector's circle on the 24th of August. But we're also talking about me doing a narrative for a PowerPoint for the exhibition that'll be at the Asheville Art Museum. But I want to see both of the exhibitions, and Tom Patterson is coming from Winston-Salem to review the Asheville Art Museum. And I'm assuming I'll write to him, be sure he'll be aware that your show is across the street.
That's lovely.
There'll be a lot of material for that. I tried to urge their PR department to be in touch with Charlotte and Atlanta. There'll be more media interest than they realized. You brought up this giant painting, one of John's last two paintings, New River Rocks and Washes, sometimes called River Rocks and Washes. John and Dominique Dumanil bought the first one, which was River Rocks and Smoke. And then a year later, Adelaide Dumanil bought River Rocks and Washes. And it was wrapped up in glassine, fortunately, in a tube, and lost for 27 years. You know, the original steps that's in Bremen, Marguerite lost that for 5 years. She lost that painting for 5 years, and she found it in a closet in a hallway in, I think, the building, her gallery in Combe. I had given up.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never gave up with Sean Mooney, and Sean Mooney kept looking for it. And I think they found it in Deer Park or someplace. They might have found it out near the Hamptons. The Manils had so many storage places.
It was in Long Island.
Just marked.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of indication on what it was, and there it was. And then you had the premiere. It hadn't been shown
at the Bob Rauschenberg
Gallery.
In 2019.
You know, we have pictures of it in a museum in the Netherlands, but
yeah, it was such a
thrill. Bob Rauschenberg Gallery, and yeah, it did bring the public in too. I tried to point that out to the Asheville folks. I said, you know, people, once this goes in the Manila collection, which I believe it's going to do, it'll be with its companion piece. They mirror each other in the configuration of the rocks.
Exactly.
John wanted to do the same parade of rocks, but one is much lighter than the other. One is smoke and one is washes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I've got to work out with them, being sure they get the trough, the brush, the things he used. We still have the rocks.
We have to wrap this up because we're running out of time and we want to be able to play some Cage. So I'm going to figure that out. It's been a real pleasure to talk to both of you. And I hope that fate, it's what it feels like these days, that fate brings us all together in Asheville at some point.
That'd be wonderful. It isn't that it's that far for me. It's just, you know, I would prefer to go at times when we're not doing big events. It's not going to be 300 people.
Ray, you could just sneak in. Don't tell anybody you're coming, except me and Jake.
That's right.
And maybe Jeff Arnell, he could know.
We've got keys, no problem.
That's right. So we'll just...
private gathering.
We'll get you a funny nose, you know? It's been a pleasure, you guys. Thank you so much. I'll alert you both when we're going to air.
Lovely to see you.
Well, thank you, Laura.
A pleasure.
It's been very enjoyable. And thank you for inviting me. And Jade, it's been wonderful to be with you.
Same. Take care of both of you.
Take care, guys.
Soon.
Now, on to a bit of music. In 1983, the Virginia Tech Percussion Ensemble, including Professors Kent Holliday on piano, John Floyd on drum, and two students, performed John Cage's Amores, a 1943 composition for prepared piano and percussion. This was followed by John Cage reading a section of his Mois, writing for the fifth time through Finnegan's Wake from 1982, which was followed by a Q&A period with the audience. Note that Cage's Mois from 1982 is distinct from his Mois II, which is Cage's writing through Ulysses. Mois II was composed in 1992 and remains unpublished. We're going to listen to Cage's Amores, composed first in 1936 and revised in 1943. It premiered in New York on February 7th of that year at the Museum of Modern Art, presented in association with the League of Composers. Its performers included Cage's wife, Xenia Cage, as well as Merce Cunningham. It's scored for small ensemble and comprises two solos for prepared piano with the addition of two trios for percussion. Movements 1 and 4, both solos for prepared piano, were used as music for the eponymous choreographed piece by Merce Cunningham, which premiered in the summer of 1949. The preparations comprise 9 screws, 8 bolts, 2 nuts, and 3 strips of rubber. The piano part expresses eroticism and tranquility and is based on the permanent emotions in Indian tradition. Trio number 2 was written in Santa Monica, California, and is part of Cage's trio from 1936. Amores is dedicated to Rue Shaw, niece of Rue Winterbotham, one of the founders of the Arts Club in Chicago, who became its president in 1940. Amores was published in 1943 by Henry Cowell in his New Music series, becoming Cage's first published composition. This was also one of the compositions Cage himself performed on the Italian quiz show, Lascia o Raddoppia, January 1959, wherein he ultimately won 5 million lira, which was about $6,000.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.